Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. Republicans and Democrats agree on this much: America's overpopulated and expensive prison system needs change. States from Louisiana to California have been overhauling their criminal justice policies. Now, the House of Representatives is readying a vote on a bill to improve prison conditions and give a hand to those released. President Trump convened a summit at the White House Friday to take on the issue. But is it enough to get started fixing a laundry list of problems in the criminal justice system? This hour on Point, reforming the U.S. prison system. You can join us on air or online. Do you think Congress will pass a prison reform bill? Do our lawmakers need to do more to address the overpopulated prison system? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later this hour, we'll discuss the mass shooting at Santa Fe High School in Texas. But first, joining me now from Washington is Heather Cagle, congressional reporter at Politico. Heather, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having me.
Well, take us through the main points in the bill now circulating in the House. What does it set out to do?
So the bill would essentially allot about $50 million a year to establish training programs for people who are currently incarcerated. And so they're educational programs, but also vocational programs. And the prisoners could enroll in these programs and then, as part of their enrollment, earn credit that would allow them to serve part of the end of their sentence in either home confinement or halfway houses. And now, not every prisoner would be allowed to earn these credits, which is part of the controversy surrounding the bill, but some of them would. And then the idea is that when they get out and they are equipped with these vocational, educational training programs, they're less likely to be repeat offenders and come back into the system.
$50 million doesn't seem like much of a price tag when you're talking about one of the largest incarcerated populations in the world.
Yeah, you know, I think that there has definitely been some debate over that. Supporters of the bill say, hey, look, we are getting some money for this program. This is definitely not the end of the road. There's a lot more that needs to be done in the area of criminal justice, but this is a start. Please work with us on this. And they look at it as kind of the one chance to do some kind of bipartisan bill this Congress in an election year that can address at least part of this problem.
Speaking of that one chance, are there parts of the proposals that are seen as sort of core proposals that really could get widespread agreement on, that don't attract the ire of some of the detractors, while some look like they may have to go in order to get to yes?
Well, I think that people in the criminal justice world, people that want to see criminal justice reform, really like the idea of training programs for prisoners, of looking at ways to equip them with job skills that they need to help reduce offenses if they when they get out on the other side. The issue is, how does the federal prison, how did they determine which prisoners are eligible for these programs? Who's most at risk to be a repeat offender and therefore should receive priority in these programs? And then some opponents of the bill also say we cannot address the back end of criminal justice reform, which is these kind of vocational programs, without also addressing the front end, which is sentencing reforms at the same time. They say, you know, you need both to really make an impact here. And so I don't think the programs themselves are controversial, but it's how they are applied and also what's being left out of the bill that is what attracts the controversy.
From what I hear, this has set off not only the normal bickering between Republicans and Democrats, but intra-party struggles between Republicans and Republicans and Democrats and Democrats. Is that fair?
Yes, definitely. This is a very interesting case of strange bedfellows in terms of who's lining up on each side. On one side, in support of this prison reform bill, you have Congressman Hakeem Jeffries from New York, a Democrat, and Doug Collins from Georgia. They're the main pushers. But you also have the backing of Jared Kushner in the White House and President Trump, who said on Friday at this summit, send me a bill, I will sign it. You also have the Koch brothers who are in that camp. And then on the other side, you have Chuck Grassley, who is very powerful in the Senate. He's the Senate Judiciary Chairman. Dick Durbin, who's the minority whip in the Senate, Democrat. And then you have a litany of civil rights groups like the ACLU and the NAACP who are opposed to this bill. So it's the way people are lining up is not your typical Republican versus Democrat.
The president has been pretty forthright in his support, generally speaking, of prison reform. But his own attorney general, Jeff Sessions, has been one of the most stalwart voices in the Senate and then now in his new role as attorney general in opposing things like significantly reduced sentences at the state level for various kinds of crimes. You've got a man like Tom Cotton, senator from Arkansas, who says this thing is dead. We are not going to take it up. Is the president, in effect, working at cross purposes with his own attorney general?
That's a very interesting question and one that hasn't totally been answered. So on this prison reform bill, the White House was consulted and the Department of Justice through the Attorney General's office was discussed or consulted over months, the language in this bill, and went back and forth. And Sessions was at the summit at the White House on Friday, which supporters of the bill took as him backing the proposal. But the Attorney General has not come out for the proposal specifically, and there is some questions behind the scenes about whether he actually does support it or whether he will come out against it or try to derail it in any way as it moves through Congress. So that's something that's playing out behind the scenes right now that we could see move to the forefront as this bill comes up for a vote in the House tomorrow and maybe the Senate this summer.
That's Heather Cagle. She's a congressional reporter at Politico. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ray. Have a good one.
Joining us now from Los Angeles, California, is Van Jones, president and co-founder of #Cut50, a national initiative to reduce the prison population. He's also a CNN political commentator. Van Jones, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here.
And joining us now from New York is Inamai Chettiar, justice program director at the Brennan Center, a public policy institute focusing on democracy and justice issues. Inamai Chettiar, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Van Jones, isn't the arena, the center of the action in this whole movement, the states? Why so much attention to this federal bill?
Well, first of all, you are correct that the 90% of prisoners are locked up at the state level. And I've spent about 30 years working at the state level. You know, here in California, I was part of an effort. We closed 5 youth prisons in California, cut the youth prison population by about 80%. No increase in youth violence or youth crime, helped to reform a couple of police departments here. So I'm a marathoner on this stuff. The problem is that the federal system still has 200,000 human beings, and they set the tone and they set the direction for everything. And for, you know, 8 years under Obama, we fought and fought and fought to try to get something done comprehensively on criminal justice reform, and we came up with a big fat goose egg. Eric Holder did as much as he could from the Department of Justice, but we got zero, zilch, zip, nada, nothing done in 8 years under Obama, and some people want us to stick with the same strategy. Our view at this point is to continue to do the same thing and expect a different outcome is the definition of insanity. There is an opportunity to take yes for an answer on prison reform, which is not the whole enchilada, but it is the first bite. And that would mean that, you know, about 4,000 federal prisoners would come home. You'd have people who are able to earn their way home sooner. There'd be a cost savings that would get kicked back over into programs to help people. And we'd at least for once have a bipartisan consensus in Congress that something should happen. And that's really what the fight's about.
Inamai Chettiar, do you agree that this could send a powerful message to 50 states in addition to having an immediate impact on the lives of people in federal lockup?
So I definitely agree that whatever happens in Congress and in Washington actually helps set the tone for states. I think that in order to really understand what's happening with this bill, you need to look back at the context. And so in terms of what happened under Obama, there actually was a bipartisan compromise reached. That was called the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. And that's something that Chairman Grassley spearheaded and that a lot of Republicans weighed in on. And the reason that that bill did not pass was because of Jeff Sessions. So what's happening now is that Sessions, in a different perch now in the administration, has convinced the administration not to support sentencing reform. And so now what's happening is that there is this bipartisan compromise in Congress around sentencing reform, but it's being pitted against what Jeff Sessions wants. So the First Step Act, which is the counter bill coming out of the White House, the problem with that is that that's not the compromise. It's the sentencing bill that was the original compromise and still is the compromise in Congress.
Van Jones, we have about a minute to the break. Is this just too small bites? Too small in its scope, given the real problem with people who are convicted, sent away, and eventually returned to the streets of the country?
Listen, I think if this is all we're going to ever do, it's too little. But it's literally called the First Step Act, in case you missed it. The First Step Act. That might give you a hint that there is more to come. Listen, I think you got Republicans and Democrats all across the country. We fight on every issue, disagree on everything. This is the one issue. Everybody knows these prisons are terrible. They're overcrowded. They aren't making things better. Too many people go in there. If we can't take yes for an answer on the one area out of 99 areas, only one we agree on, then I think shame on us. And I will say one last thing before the break. It wasn't just because of Sessions that we didn't get this thing done. You had a bunch of liberals saying, let's wait for Hillary Clinton. Tomorrow will be better. We won't do this now. We're not going to fast track it because tomorrow we'll have Hillary Clinton. And look at where we are. Let's take the reform we can get today, and then fight for the one we want tomorrow.
Van Jones, Inamai Chettiar, hold on. We're discussing the push by Congress and the Trump administration to reform the U.S. prison system. You can join the conversation. Have you or your family been affected by mass incarceration? What changes do you want to see? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're discussing reforming the U.S. prison system. You can join the conversation. Do you stand with Attorney General Jeff Sessions' hard stance on crime? What would it take for people behind bars to have a fair second chance outside prison? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Van Jones is with me, president and co-founder of Cut 50, along with Inamai Chettiar, justice program director at the Brennan Center. At the White House Prison Reform Summit Friday, President Trump said the national program to hire American workers must include formerly incarcerated people.
This has never been done in our country. It's never been done. We're going to give people that chance, and we're going to give people a chance at great success. A friend of mine told me that when people get out of prison, they're all excited. And then they go, and they have that stigma. They can't get a job. People don't want to hire them. They can't get that chance.
That's one of the challenges. What happens after your sentence is over? Take a listen to Topeka Sam, a prison reform activist associated with Van Jones Cut 50. She was at the White House Friday describing the hardships women face in prison. Topeka was formerly incarcerated.
Women are victimized and traumatized over and over again. You know, we've experienced sexual violence and abuse, and then we have to be subjected to having male guards watch us undress just because they want to. It's no threat. You know, we have to ask for pads or tampons when that is a natural thing that we have to go through, right? And then when we have to pay for them, we have to pay for them at the same amount that we do in the street, yet their jobs are only being paid for $5.25 a month.
Proposals circulating on Capitol Hill have to do not only with conditions behind bars, but making the transition out into rehabilitation and back into the general population. Manchester, Connecticut joins us. Tom, welcome to On Point.
Yes. Hi, Ray. Yes. Yes, I just wanted to comment about rehabilitation reform. I was a former correction officer about 35 years ago in the state of Connecticut. In fact, I worked near one of our state jails, and I saw, you know, problems then, like, get discharged some and they come back again, but will they get a second chance with some? We have in Connecticut, ban the box so they can, get any type of necessary vocational or technical skills. I know there's still opposition for them getting, like, a college degree versus middle-class family, so that's another barrier. And then when you get a probation and parole, you're still under guidance there not to screw up, so you won't wind up back in jail or with the wrong crowd. So it's almost like you want them to succeed, but I think there's morality there if you're from the street versus like the suburbs. I think there's like a class issue there, not just with ethnicity and, you know, gender notwithstanding, but it's just seems to be like a revolving cycle. And many years ago, a professor Gans talked about in 1975, it's prison and welfare, the 2 out of 11 uses of poverty. I guess it provides a job for people, you know, obviously, but at the same time, you know, what are the, you know, good results? I think there have been some success stories, but also some setbacks. And now with the war on drugs and terror and all that stuff, it just seems like it's like, a pushback in one way. And under Attorney General Sessions, I just see not a good sign after this cover story about him in Time magazine about a month ago, where he stands, so I'm not too sure with him. I'm trying to say the glass is half full, but right now in this atmosphere, maybe President Trump is on to something, but words are one thing, actions and deeds are another thing, and then you have all underneath in the private system in prisons. I think there's been exploitations there, you know, as well. I don't know if you still have road or chain gangs in some places if you're doing, hard time versus sweet crime if you're a white-collar criminal.
Well, so let me turn to Inamai Chettiar. Tom, thanks a lot for your call, and it's great to have a view from inside, from someone who was a corrections officer. Are we, Inamai Chettiar, looking at the whole person? Yes, Van Jones, absolutely right. This is the first step. What are we missing when we try to solve this knotty puzzle of what to do from the people among us who've committed crimes, who've committed crimes against the social order, who've hurt people, and then want to be part of civil society again?
Right. So I think the real problem here is mass incarceration, right? That is the locking up of 2.3 million Americans, mostly black and brown. And the real way to solve that is to reduce the number of people entering prison so that there are not people suffering unnecessarily in prison. And I think that when you step back to look at what the solution is to that, that is sentencing reform as opposed to what the White House is trying to do, which what they're calling quote-unquote prison reform, which basically is code for helping people while they're in prison but not actually letting them out or reducing the number of people flowing in. So
let me sharpen that a little bit, because for a long time when we were trying to incarcerate our way out of our crime problem, it sounded like the public's temper, the public's desire, was to make prison as mean and nasty and degrading and dehumanizing as possible as punishment. Make sentences as long as possible. That was the way politicians earned their bones in the game of talking to the public. Nobody went, until recently, nobody said, we ought to start lowering penalties. But now we have the legacy of that. We have people treated badly as a way of showing our distaste for what they did. How do you unravel that? How do you walk that back?
So over the last 10 years, there's actually been a remarkable movement, not only among politicians, but also among voters' perception of this. So there are many polls showing that the vast majority of Republicans and Democrats agree with the idea of reducing the prison population. And more politicians, I would say the vast majority of them, actually agree with this as well. And that is a very stark contrast from where we've been in the past. And that opens the door to actually being able to solve the problem.
Baltimore, Maryland is next. James, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for taking my call. Just to give you guys a brief description, I'm 27 years old. I'm from Baltimore. My mother's white. My father's black. I've lived in poor neighborhoods and neighborhoods that are very well off. The fact of the matter is I have siblings that have been incarcerated, and it really takes a big toll and a big effect on the family and the children and everything. And the fact of the matter is, if you do something wrong that you shouldn't do, there are consequences. We all know that. That's a given. But the fact of the matter is that I think we as a nation need to focus on what we can do after the fact. And I think job training, vocational training, education, psychiatric help, I think all of these things are key to making the process better. You know, we cannot stop people from doing things that they are not supposed to do. We all know that. But the follow-up on how to make that person a better functional member of society is what we as a people, as a nation, need to come together and get on the same page with, because solving the problem is really what matters. And thanks for taking my call again.
Thanks a lot for your call, James. Van Jones, do we know that, for instance, the recidivism rate is lower among released people who can find steady employment versus those who have a troubled tenure in the workplace?
Well, absolutely. And part of what excited me about this First Step Act bill that is, Hakeem Jeffries' bill. I mean, he and Doug Collins and the House have been the ones fighting for it and trying to make something happen, is that it goes exactly to what the caller is talking about. When people come home, they need to come home job ready. If you send people home not job ready, it's going to be hard on them and hard on their families. This is a bill that gives people incentive inside. If you take the classes and you do the work, you can come home earlier. That's a big incentive, and also there's a big cost savings there that we then have that plowed back into more programs and more classes. So you literally could have a virtuous cycle. Is this a perfect bill? No, it's not. First of all, Jeff Sessions has to implement it, and we know Jeff Sessions is no friend of any of these ideas. You got to go get the money. Just because they authorize it doesn't mean they're going to appropriate it. So it's going to be a long fight to even get this meaningful but modest set of reforms in. But what I insist that we do is that we don't walk away from actual positive progress because we don't like Jeff Sessions, we don't like Donald Trump, we just don't want anything to happen unless it's perfect. That has failed us even under Democratic administration. And again, I also want to be very clear, even though I work for CNN, I'm not wearing my CNN hat today. I'm wearing my cut50.org hat. That's cut50.org hat. And we've got a 40-state network. We've got legislation in 10 states right now to do similar work. We just think it's time. Everybody talks about it. Everybody's got an idea. I worked in a prison. My kid was in prison. I'm a politician. Can we do something? Can we pass a bill? Can we actually get somewhere? Because I believe that progress leads to progress. The other, my other good liberal friends say progress will lead to nothing because if we do one positive thing, we'll stop and nothing will happen for 100 years. That is not what's happening in the states. In the states, they take one step, then they take two, then they take 10. And we need to get that process started at the federal level. Hakeem Jeffries' First Step Act is the first step, and it needs to be supported.
Oklahoma City, Oklahoma is next. Bill, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Okay, Bill. How you doing?
Pretty well, sir. I'm a 30-plus year veteran of the corrections system. I want to cut the chase. I know your time is limited. There's a couple things everybody's missing in this whole scenario. Oklahoma incarcerates more women than anybody in the entire world, and we're in the top five as far as men is concerned. But one problem exacerbates the other. Minimum sentencing guidelines is a good impact. Fighting the war on drugs is a good impact. But there's a disconnect between law enforcement and corrections. Example being, you put people on probation, DA's councils and local law enforcement go for the lowest lying fruit. They pick the lowest level of fruit because it's easy access. You put a guy on probation who's been incarcerated for 10 years, and you set him a fine of $50 to $75 to $100 a month. Okay? The first time he misses a probation payment, a bench warrant wants to be issued for his arrest. Well, then once he's arrested, he goes into the county or local jail municipalities. Well, then they begin to assess a daily fee from $30 to as much as $45 a day. So that's taxpayer money, no matter how you look at it. So, and it's not a bipartisan issue. Oklahoma was a blue state since statehood and recently became a red state. The issue that we had with incarceration numbers growing such as they are occurred during us being a liberal democratic state. What it amounts to is everybody wants to be tough on crime, not smart on crime. And we've reached a point in Oklahoma where it's fiscal saturation. You know, we can't afford to incarcerate any more people because what happens is everything else in your community suffers. Your school system suffers, social services, health care for the elderly suffer. Everything suffers because your number one priority begins to be incarceration and maintaining your incarceration levels.
Let me turn to Inamai Chettiar. Bill, thank you for your reality check right from ground zero there, a corrections officer calling from Oklahoma City. He says, we're tough, but we're not smart. He's probably met people who he wonders why they're in jail in the first place. What does being smart mean now, at this point, when the United States is incarcerating a share of its population unlike any other country on the planet?
So I think that the example of what's happening in Oklahoma is a really good one. So the governor, a Republican, championed a package to affirmatively reduce the number of people entering prison and to also assist with people reentering society. And I think that is really the solution. And that is what basically that's what's been happening in states across the country, and that is something that the federal government can replicate right now. And there is a bill on the table, right? That's the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. Interestingly, what the caller pointed out is sentencing reform is actually supported by corrections officers, law enforcement, Republicans, Democrats. I mean, this is what everybody is looking to as the solution.
But does diversion save money and make the public safer? That's
yes,
really the question. People want to know, okay, fine, so you're not putting someone away, but am I in danger because they're still out among us?
So I think that there is a false notion that incarceration brings down crime. And I think that what we have learned is that diversion programs that provide alternatives to imprisonment and education and anti-recidivism programs, those are what is the most effective at reducing crime and not just incarceration.
So this is wanting in your view. What about Van Jones' suggestion that we've got to start somewhere and that this is a good start?
Right. So I think that, you know, I think that misses the point that there actually is this compromise bill, which is the sentencing reform bill, right? And that's the one that Republicans, Democrats, law enforcement support. The First Step Act is actually a step backwards. That's a cave to Jeff Sessions. And what it does is it would hand Trump a political win without actually doing much to end mass incarceration.
Can I say something about that?
Quickly, Van.
This is a big problem. You have people, and I'm glad somebody finally told the truth of it. You have a lot of people, and you know some concerns are more legitimate than others, but this is the one I'm most concerned about. We don't want Trump to have a win. How about giving 200,000 federal prisoners a win to have a chance to be able to come home? I remember when Barack Obama passed Obamacare, and you had Republican governors who refused to take the money to expand Medicaid and let people get sick and die in their states. because they knew that they had millions of people who were too, quote-unquote, rich for Medicaid but too poor for Obamacare. They let those people fall through the cracks, get sick, and die rather than give Barack Obama a, quote-unquote, victory. We cannot let that become the way we do politics, where the people at the bottom who have nothing, who are vulnerable, who are hurting, can't get relief because somebody's doing a political calculation about what politician is going to get benefit.
I'm going to give Inamai Chettiar a quick chance to respond before we go. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. So I absolutely agree that we should be thinking about the people in prison and doing what we can for those people on the ground who are suffering. The Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act would release 7,000 people immediately, 3,000 people every year, and up to 70,000 people could be released under it.
And well, mandatory minimums. But go ahead.
Well, that's all we have time for right now. Van Jones, president and co-founder of Cut 50, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
And Inamai Chettiar, Justice Program Director at the Brennan Center. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
After the break, we'll take stock of American mass shootings following the tragedy at Santa Fe High School in Texas. You can join the conversation. What are your thoughts, your conclusions, after more student lives are lost to gun violence? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
There's nothing like a movie theater on a hot day, and there's nothing like a good show you can binge watch with a cold glass of lemonade. Summer is the perfect time to find your next favorite thing, and Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help. Find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. At least 10 people were killed by a 17-year-old student at Santa Fe High School in Texas Friday. Again, the country is mourning, opening up the debate on gun control, school safety, mental health. And we try out 13 ways of looking at a white boy, a teenage boy wearing a trench coat who posted "Born to Kill" on his Facebook page, planned to murder schoolmates and kill himself. You can join the conversation. More armed guards, metal detectors, fewer exits. What needs to change at school? Or is it gun laws that need to change? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Columbia, Tennessee via Skype is David French, senior writer for National Review. You can link to his recent story headlined "The Best Explanation for Our Spate of Mass Shootings is the Least Comforting" at our website, onpointradio.org. David, welcome to On Point.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it very much.
And for people who haven't read the story, decode that for us. The best explanation, the least comforting. What did you mean?
Yeah, so I went back to a very important 2015 essay in The New Yorker from Malcolm Gladwell that I think was eerily prescient of what we're experiencing. And in essence, what Gladwell's thesis was that we're in the midst of, and ever since Columbine, that we're in the midst of what he characterized as a slow motion riot, almost like a contagion, where the threshold for each new mass killing was being lowered by each previous mass killing, so that a person who commits the next mass killing is maybe, perhaps, and this is counterintuitive to an awful lot of people, less disturbed than the person who committed the mass killing before, and that the grievances and the sense of grievance, or the mental difficulties or mental health problems, or the level of rage of various mass killers is actually decreasing as mass killings get normalized. And it's an extremely provocative and interesting thesis, but it's one that's grounded in an awful lot of disturbing data, in particular in the way in which the Columbine killers have achieved an almost cult-like status in this very small subgroup of people who either ponder or who commit mass killings. And one of the things that stood out to me in the initial reporting of this Texas, terrible Texas killing, was the way in which the killer, at least based on these early reports, had copied elements of the Columbine shootings, down to trench coat wearing, down to attempted use of explosives in addition to firearms, and even the kinds of firearms he used, although he took them from his father. The Columbine killers also had shotguns, had handguns also. And so there was there are elements of this that suggest very elaborate and very premeditated copycatting going on at scale around the country, and that this is something that is, as Gladwell noted in remarks later, is very difficult to deal with. It is not susceptible to quick, easy gun control solutions. Instead, it's a phenomenon that has become deeply rooted in a subset of our culture, and therefore very difficult to root out.
So, David French, once the model, once the matrix is created by Harris and Klebold in April of 1999, that's 19 years ago, and this young fellow, Dimitrios Pangourtsis, is 17 years old. So he's
right.
Looking back to something that happened before he was born.
Well, and the interesting thing is this is not, again, you know, there's a lot we don't know about this current shooting. But if you look at other shootings, not just at home, but also abroad, a shockingly high percentage of school shooters or attempted school shooters have explicit callbacks to Columbine. It's almost as if when Columbine happened, something snapped. There were multiple school shootings before Columbine, but before Columbine, they were disconnected and very idiosyncratic. After Columbine, you began to see these very common themes emerging. And as bizarre and weird as it sounds, there was almost a cult of personality that grew up around Harrison Klebold, and that it actually echoes beyond school shootings. And so this is something that when we're thinking through the challenge of mass shootings, which is a category of crime, it's distinct from, you know, normal, what you would call, quote unquote, normal gun crime, and it's distinct as a category of gun death that's different from suicides, that it presents some extremely challenging scenarios for law enforcement, for families, for school officials, as they're trying to figure out how to deal with this crisis.
As disturbing as the suggestion is that once the Columbine model, let's say, is injected into the public bloodstream, you can't get it out, our collective subconscious, as disturbing as that is, what's more shocking for me is the near mathematical way both you and Gladwell lay out this idea that the threshold to being able to commit a crime like this is shallower with each subsequent crime. That makes preventing them almost feel like it's impossible.
Well, right. And you know, this latest shooting, again, you know, we're still early in the investigation, is very different and feels different in some ways from the Parkland shooting. In the Parkland shooting, the shooter gave off warning sign after warning sign after warning sign. Here in this circumstance, people are trying to stitch together what were the warning signs. And, you know, they've come up with the wore a Born to Kill shirt, or he had this or, you know, that kind of clothing that was alarming. But, you know, if you have much interaction with teenage boys, you know that the number of boys who will, you know, wear a provocative shirt or say something provocative online is almost limitless. And so, you know, this one almost seems to fit perfectly within that Gladwellian thesis that says that more normal, quote-unquote normal, although you can never call somebody who does this normal, but more quote-unquote normal people will contemplate this as this contagion, as this sort of slow-motion riot, as he described it, spreads. And the really interesting thing is to sort of track this phenomenon, not just school shootings, but, you know, mass shootings more broadly in our culture. We have a real distinct serious crisis right now of these nation-shaking mass shootings, with people coming at them from a variety of different backgrounds and a variety of different surface motivations, but time and time again fitting similar patterns.
Rapid City, South Dakota's next. Tim, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi, Ray. Thanks for taking the call. I was listening to probably most of On Point's sessions around gun control and shootings for many, many months now. And my observations are two. I have 2 points to make. And one, feeding off of your prior segment, there's an individual, one of your guests said, let's just do something, that progress leads to progress. Baby steps will lead to bigger things and better solutions. I think that applies to this situation as well. My 2 points are this. Number one, as one of the news programs said, Sunday morning programs, one individual said, let's stop publicly announcing the shooter's name and making these people icons to some troubled youths and creating the cult-like responses that some people are having. So why we're glamorizing to some individuals the individual person and shooter's name is kind of an easy fix for me to stop doing it. If the press could jump on board with that, we could have a great start. And number two, parental responsibility. There's probably no school shooting situation that screams for elevating that discussion than this particular tragedy. In Newtown, perhaps it has an element of that. But quite honestly, if you follow the NRA safety protocols, you have everything locked up. And there's no way that your child or young adult should be able to access a weapon. That's really my thoughts.
David French, how do you respond to Tim?
Yeah, you know, I think that when we're looking at the problem of mass shootings, first we have to understand there's no silver bullet. There's no particular gun control method that's going to put a stop to it. There are a lot of things we have to think through. And one of the things that I have talked about, and this is actually a solution that has come from some progressive thinkers on thinking sort of creatively about how to deal with gun violence. And this is something called the gun violence restraining order. And a gun violence restraining order essentially takes a look at the reality of a lot of these mass killings, which is, aside from the Texas shooting, often these guys give off a ton of warning signs, and yet family members and school officials do not have great legal tools at their disposal to deal with them. And what a gun violence restraining order does is it allows a person like a family member or, say, a school principal to go to a local court and seek, with full due process, a temporary restraining order to take guns from a person who has demonstrated that they're a danger to themselves or others. And this is something that I think has real promise because, again, the Texas shooting aside, and if you look at mass shootings time and time again, you will have seen clear warning signs where many of the people around the shooter will have felt helpless in knowing how to deal with it. So I think there's a tool there that people should think about and should consider that respects due process, it respects the Second Amendment, and responds to the actual facts on the ground. Because one of the things that you've seen time and time and time again with these mass shooters is that these mass shootings are elaborately planned, and they often, as I said, sort of wave around red flags. Now, again, that's not a solution for every case. And for example, in this Texas shooting, one of the things that's so chilling about it is it doesn't seem to be a kid where everyone suspected this or everyone predicted this. But again, that I think that's a step that respects the Second Amendment, respects constitutional notions of due process, but gives families and school officials a tool to take some proactive steps.
David French, do you think it's realistic, given the temper of the times, given that even some of the seemingly simplest proposals die in legislatures without being acted upon because of the fraught nature of the debate over guns in this country?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's some hope on the gun violence restraining order front. The NRA has endorsed the concept. You saw red state Florida pass a very similar kind of law through the legislature after Parkland. There's been widespread bipartisan support for the concept, but you know, as we know, there can be bipartisan support for legislative initiatives, and we still hit gridlock. That's a sad reality of our times. But I do think there is hope here. And the other thing is, I think we're beginning to reach a point because, as I said earlier, these mass shootings are nation-shaking events. These are events that are deeply felt across the political spectrum, across the country, And as they seem to be happening, and they, you know, there's statistical debates about the frequency of them, but there doesn't seem to be much debate about the lethality of them these days, that they seem to be more lethal and happening with regularity, that I think there will be increasing openness to a combination of prophylactic measures like the gun violence restraining order, improved mental health, improved attention on mental health, and defensive measures. While we're waiting for some of the prophylactic measures to have an effect, what can you do to harden the target more than we are already doing? And those kinds of things, I think, have to happen in tandem.
A caller from St. Albans, Vermont, checked in to remind us that Matthew Milby, a 19-year-old Dixon, Illinois man who authorities say fired shots near a gymnasium full of students at the local high school, exchanged gunfire with a school resource officer. He was taken into custody and charged with 3 felony counts of aggravated discharge of a firearm. Thomas thought that that story wasn't getting enough coverage in the current context of Santa Fe. We'll make one last stop this hour, Evansville, Indiana. April, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. As a former teacher, I wanted to make a comment about the framework within a school system. I feel 20 years ago, we had a counselor for boys and a counselor for girls and a full-time nurse on staff, and we've really gotten away from that because of budget issues. They feel as if we had that framework available to us still, that maybe that we could preempt some of these shootings and some of the issues that the kids are dealing with.
So, April, what do you think about the proposal from David French? He just explained it earlier about a gun violence restraining order, that the kinds of things that you were talking about being detected once upon a time might actually land you in a court, get you a hearing, and if it's felt that there's need, to take away your firearms.
I'm actually against guns, so I am okay with that. I think we spend way too much time fighting about whether you should have a gun or not. I think that we are past that point, that we really need to just make some progress forward. And if that means that we have to take away someone's gun, then that means that less children are going to die.
April, thanks a lot for your call. Final thoughts, David French, before we wrap it up for this hour?
Yeah, I think that the key here is to not look at what we're dealing with as a problem with a simple solution, where we can immediately fall back to our PAT idea that says, you know, on the right, it's often, well, we just need to harden the target and have, you know, legislative regimes where teachers have guns. And on the left, it says, well, universal background checks or assault weapons ban. And we immediately seem to retreat to these corners. I think one of the key things about understanding the true dimension of the problem is understanding the complexity of the problem, and that's a first step to realistic responses.
David French, senior writer for National Review, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Anna Bowman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Cozzonis, Allison Poli, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Raleigh, Jeremy Relosa, and James Ross. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up tomorrow, President Trump demands the Justice Department find out if the FBI spied on his campaign. We'll look at the evidence. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.